Hello. Welcome back to Who Listens to This Crap. This is going to be the first of hopefully many special episodes where we're going to do a deep dive into a specific band. This week, I guess in lieu of autumn and just everything spooky, we're doing Smashing Pumpkins, which I don't know. I'm joined by Nate.
Yes, indeed. I'm sitting here with this one. Talking about one of my favorite bands of all time.
Exactly. You want to give us a little spiel of what you do?
A little spiel about what I do? Yeah. I'm the station manager, obviously, at Radio Laurier. Anyone who works here has probably met me. What do I do here? I do finger guns, and I tell people to get in front of the mics and talk.
Yeah, pretty much. I come in, and he sits me down, and he goes, do your thing. And I go, all right, let me do my
stop
thing.
Stop monkeying. Start recording.
Yes,
that's our new slogan.
Big letters.
Thank God for
on a whiteboard.
Our editing manager, our production manager, Carissa, is massively into primatology now as a result of like courses in archaeology and stuff at Laurier. Mm-hmm. And she has been a real driving force in our branding shifting ever closer to just being monkey and banana related.
Okay.
They're popping up around the office here. We're seeing them on coasters for when we do a logo redesign thing. It's Radio Laurier is gradually shifting away from any terrestrial radio thematic kind of vibe, and we're moving very much toward monkeys.
I think that's amazing.
It is indeed. Like, to see anyone so passionate about something that they're willing to take what is a proud legacy, some 50 years strong of Radio Laurier, and be like, you know what? Monkey time.
And take all the past, everything that's been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Go further back.
Go further back. No, go further back.
Before the human race. Mm-hmm. We're talking monkeys now.
Just primates.
Exactly. And when we say primates, not all the primates.
No.
Lemurs?
Just monkeys.
Get them out of here.
Yeah.
Apes? There's an ape up
there.
Oh, we're more interested.
No, absolutely not.
We want monkeys. Anyway, speaking of monkeys, Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins,
he's
always monkeying around this
guy.
He
really is. That's the thing that we're going to be talking about a little bit throughout the next hour. Just Smashing Pumpkins as it relates to its lead singer, and we're gonna dive deep on Well, it's been named a few things. I call it John Lennon-itis.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
The disease where a beautiful, brilliant band, a triple B as we call them here on Who Listens to This Crap, has four contributing members. And one of them, usually the lead singer, but occasionally the guitarist, has all the ego for all four of them put together, and it ends up driving the whole band into the ground. Billy Corgan is a sufferer.
Sufferer, but it's like self-suffering, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely.
This is all something that he has put upon himself.
Yeah, he's doing fine for it. He owns a wrestling company and a cafe and stuff now.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he owns, I don't remember what it's, I think it's the National Wrestling Association, which I only remember because its acronym is NWA, which is great. Go off.
That, nothing's ever been, used those initials
no,
ever.
No,
no.
It's only memorable because my name is Nate, and there's also a W in it. I don't know, it's, he's had a remarkable post-Pumpkins career trajectory in that, he's never hit the same highs. He's railed against the press for, not only not loving his music, but also not hating it. When Oceania came out, one of their albums in the mid-aughts, it got a bunch of kind of meh reviews from around the sphere. And, he launched into a tirade, I think on Facebook or something, just about how that's the real slow death of an artist.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's honestly really compelling to watch someone it's like a frog boiling in a pot. Just you can watch him seeing the end of his relevance. But I say that, but I think he's kind of shifted into grandfather mode in recent years. He's just going on stage with not Smashing Pumpkins.
My Chemical Romance was the most recent. Yeah.
Yes, Green Day. He's at this point, I think he's reached the point that most rock stars reach where you kind of acknowledge that you were the voice of a very specific generation of bedroom bound Gen Xers, and you will never, those Gen Xers are dead and buried in their flannels and like cat's eye goth makeup. They have grown into soccer moms and dads who voted Trump but don't tell anyone about it because they used to be into alt stuff when they were young. And like, he's kind of, I don't know whether he's consciously at this point, but he's like, I'm happy to be remembered for when I was like, when I changed children's lives.
Back when I had hair.
Exactly. Back when I had hair, or back when I was sort of bald by choice.
Yeah.
When I, before it was 100% not.
I was bald when, like, but it was a choice and it was cool.
Yeah. Like, I assume his hair was going, but like, he's got to be one of the most iconic bald, like, rock singers. Sorry for knocking the mic there.
Oh, you're good. No, like, I think.
It's got to be him, Michael Stipe. Who else?
Tom Morello.
Yeah. Not a singer, but yes, I think he counts. Mm-hmm.
I feel like also Tom Morello in recent years has like occupied that.
He's in unk mode a bit.
A little bit, but
he's still on everything for some reason.
The amount of features that man has is kind of insane.
Indeed, it's unbelievable. And you know what? Good for him. Get that bag.
I guess, but it was no. Rage Against the Machine. Yeah, it talk is. About get that bag. Okay,
he's got the bag.
This also goes back to like the Gen X people that vote for Trump.
Where, oh boy, yeah, he's got some of those.
The leaps in logic that, like, what you call it, old heads? I'm gonna use the hip-hop term. I'm gonna use, like, old heads in terms of the alt or punk scene, where they try to, their politics have veered completely to the opposite direction of any kind of music that they listen to. So they justify their politics within their music being, oh, the real punk rock is voting for Trump and
real punk rock is following the rule.
Yeah, supporting fascism.
Yeah, dude. Thank you, former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, for like coming out and being pro Rage Against the Machine, and then every member of Rage Against the Machine being like, Dog, you're the machine. No, it's you. You're the machine.
Just completely missing the mark.
Dog, mm-hmm. you can't be doing this.
No,
we'll do what they told you. That's a good thing.
Okay.
Some of those who burn crosses are also cool.
Kind of. Yeah. They actually suck. They're.
To be clear, the people who burn crosses are bad.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, anyway, but speaking of the Smashing Pumpkins and some unks, we're going back to the beginning of their discography.
Yes.
To pick this off,
we're gonna start off with Gish. I want to emphasize that before people knew, like, Smashing Pumpkins as a name, mm-hmm. I think, which they really popped off with Melancholy, right? They released this album that was compared, like, to literally everything popular at the time.
Yeah, so Gish is really interesting for a lot of things because Gish is both like a really interesting kickoff to a career and also the beginning sort of an interesting phenomenon that lasts to this day of like, this was the beginning of indie was happening in the 90s, mm-hmm. really as a big name, like with things like Pavement, with like the punk kind of label starting to go big, random punk albums would go mm-hmm. big and you'd be like, what? Who is this? This wasn't made by Interscope. This wasn't made by Geffen. And, like, Gish was the first album I know of that was released on a quote-unquote independent label that has been riding its independent success since that day. The thing about that independent success is that, like, the label it was on was a division of Geffen. Like, it was one of those things that still happens where it had all the same money, it had all the same connections of a big label, but labels were starting to get wise to the fact that it didn't really pay to be called alt if you were obviously still like being promoted by the mainstream, mm-hmm. if you were being put out by the same people that were putting out Motley Crue or whatever. So they started doing the buying small labels thing. And I remember when I was young, before I grew up and learned anything about the world, listening to Billy Corgan on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Oh, God.
I am so sorry. And hearing him talk about, like, Gish, the biggest independent release of all time at the time. And I was like, whoa, damn, that's actually pretty mm-hmm. interesting. And I looked it up and I was like, that's all. Oh, so that was a damn lie? Like, anyway.
That's the same thing with, like, that record label STC, I think, where it's, like, oh, it's this indie kind of mm-hmm. producer. But, they like, if you go through, like, on Wikipedia, they have, like, produced some of the biggest, like, albums of all time.
Yeah.
With some, like, huge names. You see Husker Du and Descendants, I think.
Well, some of that is also, I'm Like sometimes just one label totally nails it for a little while.
Oh, for sure.
This happened with like Run for Cover or Triple Crown in the States, where it's like, oh, we've recreated emo music. Mm-hmm. And it was still indie, but like usually, yeah. It's just mm-hmm. so okay. Anyway.
Yeah, let's jump right into it. This is could be, I think, their first real single, I Am One off of Gish. Please enjoy. All right, I wasn't talking into the mic before, but yeah, that was the first big single.
Indeed, first song off that album, eh?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was the world's introduction to the Smashing Pumpkins, or realistically, a lot of the world's introduction to the Smashing Pumpkins mm-hmm. is a different song where Rat in a Cage.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first song that you heard if you listened to their published LP discography front to back.
Yeah. I was doing a little research beforehand mm-hmm. on the band, and it started off like they're all from different states, but they all came together in Chicago
mm-hmm.
And played, I think, one of their first shows was at the Metro. And which is like
that's a good venue.
Yeah, it's a fucking great venue.
It's okay. Actually, this is beef that I'm an idiot because I told some volunteers who do a podcast on here, Movie Maidens, that they were free to add things to the soundboard. But what I neglected to tell them was that the soundboard has multiple
channels?
Windows
yeah.
that mm-hmm. you can change which one. We've got 8 buttons, for those who haven't seen this.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 8 buttons, and you can tie them to sounds. And usually this red one in the top corner is a bleep.
Mm.
If someone's swearing, something like that, you want to do that. So if I had been fast, if I'd known this was coming, I could have tapped that thing and said, no, Matthew, don't say that terrible word. However, I forgot to tell some volunteers. I told volunteers they could put on some new sounds in the soundboard, forgot to tell them that they should do that on the second page of results. So now our bleep is...
Oh, it's the beep.
Well, actually,
perfect.
Ignore me.
You have no idea what the I'm saying right
that,
now.
That's actually... Yeah. That's, beautiful.
What were we talking about
before? I was ranting. So...
oh, yes.
I'm sorry for ranting. I Am One. It's a...
Yeah, so I Am One was probably a lot of people's first introductions to the band. Started off at the Metro, and it was Billy Corgan wanted to be a singer. He had this music, I guess, and he met up with James Iha, and who was a pretty good guitarist. And at the time, they really were inspired by there's a big new wave and goth scene, so taking a lot from electronic music, using a drum pad, because they didn't actually have a drummer until they met Jimmy Chamberlain, which a lot of people don't know, which I believe Jimmy is kind of that X factor that really propelled them initially, like a classical, like big band jazz drummer, just put into this goth,
this alt rock,
yeah, this alt rock
kind of uncool, weird nerds kind of thing. The thing about Jimmy Chamberlain is that he's like, obviously, Billy Corgan is a riff slinger, he's a guitar god, whatever kind of guy. But Jimmy Chamberlain is probably the best musician in the band. He is so good at doing everything that he needs to without sounding like he's doing anything at all.
It's not simplicity, but it's, I don't know, it's a level of musicianship where mm-hmm. it looks easier. Like, it will always look easier when he does it.
Exactly. It's from your background in jazz, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how jazz is a, depending on your kind of jazz, but jazz, the thing people are always saying, it's about the notes you don't play. It's about being able to give people the whole vibe without taking over the mix, without, double kick drum all the time, all the day. Just wasting a lot of people's... capacity to listen to music, just blowing out their eardrums. He's so good at making the music of the Smashing Pumpkins sound gigantic
mm-hmm.
without taking away from the bass without putting too much into the energy, which can ultimately just kind of sap it, because each individual drum stroke will lose the momentum that it has if you're just keeping it simple. He's a really impressive player, and like we start to see on the second album, as they come into their own, there's a lot of jamming kind of on the first one Starla. There's like an 11-minute song on there, and like there's still long songs on
Smashing Pumpkins is kind of known for having they'll quite a few long tracks.
Indeed. In fact, one on this album, Silverfuck, which is the name of the song. So we can say it.
Amazing. Honestly, I was about to put that in the lineup for today.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure about...
It's all right.
It's unfortunate. We are going to play a song off of Siamese Dream, which is my personal favorite album. That's what we're kind of leading up to.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit in the while I Am One was playing. But Siamese Dream is probably... It's the most... concise and clear artistic statement that the Smashing Pumpkins put out in response to like the general question, what's your deal as a band?
Yeah. So after Gish came out, I think like many new bands on this, like that come into the scene, it's always about like the comparative game, right? They go, well, this is just a copy of Cheap Trick, or this is a copy of Jane's Addiction, right? And you see those comparisons follow them throughout their career as they try to not like emulate other sounds, but they go into different directions. And Billy Corgan actually has said this himself. He kind of like, he believes for some reason that all art is dead. Like,
oh, does he?
Yeah.
Crazy. Billy Corgan's
this is another thing we're going to talk about, that Billy Corgan is so far, in his own head that, he'll just say these general broad stroke statements.
I remember him saying that religious music was the next great frontier of music in like 2001 or whatever. And that was a resurgence of like massively religious and patriotic country music for a very specific
reason. Yeah.
But like he didn't really hit the nail on the head. We've really not dived into the religion in pop music in the way he thought we would.
No, unfortunate.
Just more crying emo.
I can't complain about that either, though.
It's Billy Corgan's fault.
I know. It's all Billy Corgan's fault. Yeah, so Siamese Dream is like...
The thing about Siamese Dream is that it's an album where everything sounds like it agrees with the sound of Billy Corgan's voice. Billy Corgan, if you've never listened to the Smashing Pumpkins and you've just started tuning in while we've been talking in the last like minute, has a very kind of... acquired taste for a voice. He's got a characteristic whine.
My father says he sounds like a dying cat.
Oh, he absolutely sounds like a dying cat. And he sounds like a dying cat that's just real vindictive about dying. And he's not going to let anyone else forget about it. He's like, his voice sounds like complaining and like teen angst and this whole like, kind of thing. He could have been a bully on The Simpsons.
He but was like, on The Simpsons.
He was indeed on
The
Simpsons.
That episode always cracks me up. Homer goes, yeah, I'm Homer Simpson. I don't know who you are, but I'll smile and shake your hand.
And he's like, thanks.
Yeah.
You guys sounded really depressed. Thanks. We tried to do that or whatever the thing is.
No. Next up is Soma.
The thing that the album sounds like is, like, you'll notice, like, it's heavy attack on the drums. It's like, melodramatic. The guitars also just sound so angsty and like complainy, and Soma is perhaps the song where he's most explicitly just saying, man, I'm so sad and everything sucks. Like, it's around a lot of the album, but this is the song that is maybe the most explicit statement of like Smashing Pumpkins emo fringe before emo existed, goth makeup in your room complaining about your high school boyfriend.
Yeah, my mom's telling me to turn that garbage down as I...
Like,
it's not a phase.
Exactly.
No. So let's get right into it. This is Soma. Yeah. Thank you. All right. That was Soma. That was off Siamese Dream. During just the little break we had, we were talking about our kind of first experiences listening to the Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah. The first time that I ever listened to the Smashing Pumpkins would have been when I was very young, because my brother owned Melancholy on disc, because he... This is my little brother, who is probably like 7 at the time, got it in a White Elephant gift exchange. You know, the thing where you grab them out of the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Like they, some people call them fire hall things. Mm-hmm. He'd never listened to it before, but he liked the idea of CDs because he was a guitarist. And so we just had it. We listened to it for a while. The only thing I remembered was the Billy Corgan whine on the song Zero saying, "God is empty, just like me." And I was like, what a rude young man. When I was like 9 or whatever, this is quite uncouth. It took until I was probably like 15 or 16.
I love how poised you were for a 9-year-old.
Oh, absolutely.
Clutching your pearls.
Oh, yeah.
To the, how dare he?
I was in choir and I was in church. This was a time when I had no truck with such blasphemers and hooligans. I didn't really get into them until I was volunteering at a food bank years later, just delivering, like, you know, packets of food to people in need in the area. And just, like, most of that job was just, like, walking around waiting for other people to finish the packets of food so that we could take them out to people. Yeah. And so I was just listening to Nirvana's Nevermind quite a lot, as one does when they're 16.
Of course.
And just it autoplayed on Spotify into Bullet with Butterfly Wings at a certain point, but first into Cherub Rock. And I heard that song, the riff on that song, the as like the riff that kind of, first of all, made a career, mm-hmm. as like the first song on Siamese Dream, this kind of like the thing that defined mainstream alt for like probably the next 4 years or whatever.
What, just the heavy riffs? Yeah, like, yeah,
the heavy riffs, the things that Weezer was doing of like super melodic Sabbath tones, mm-hmm. while still staying super accessible, but also adding the kind of Nirvana angst thing, mm-hmm. and like allowing yourself to be silly and goofy. Nirvana was kind of goofy, but it was like when Nirvana wasn't being goofy, it was very like
self-serious,
and it had its punk ethos kind of mm-hmm. written into the music. Whereas,
well, I think that was a designed
thing,
right?
In Nirvana, it makes sense to mm-hmm. Be kind of trying to tear it all down or whatever. But like, the Smashing Pumpkins is this inherently suburban music. Like,
oh, for sure.
It's music that cannot let go of wankery when it comes to the guitars. It's music that cannot let go of its own problems for the sake of like collective action and feeding the whole. It's music for people who are really just sitting in something, thinking about themselves and how they affect the world around them.
Yeah, it's so personal, I feel. Mm-hmm. For so many of the songs where you can ask someone and you listen to them, like, talk about how they feel about the music, and it's so unique to the person,
yeah.
right? I listened to Smashing Pumpkins, I think, around the same time. I might have been 14 or 15.
Yeah.
And very similar. I was, what was I doing? It was probably, like, I was listening to some kind of, like, emo rock, and yeah. it, like, was a suggestion on
As
Spotify, which that's kind of what I loved about streaming when I was a kid, right? Mm-hmm. That very early on, being able to discover other bands. That's a side note. But Smashing Pumpkins was just this wall of sound that I listened to it and I was completely immersed. And I go, whatever I'm feeling right now, they've surmised it and are speaking to me directly.
Yeah, that kind of like putting just like the unescapable angst of teenage hormones into the sound of a guitar is very much a thing that they did. And like in the song that you're going to play next.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like, an Ode to No One. So we're kind of going through chronologically and then we'll kind
start
of
bouncing around
start bouncing whatever. Around again to Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, mm-hmm. which to you cannot remove from like the legacy of the Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, no.
As much as we love Siamese Dream, a lot of people will say this is the Smashing Pumpkins album. Mm. It was revolutionary, not for them specifically, because I guess they hadn't, like, to release a double EP, like, LP album, especially at the time.
And this... to, like, top the charts with it. Mm-hmm.
It was unseen. Does it create a pattern of them releasing double albums and then not getting the same success because they're trying to capture the same success? Yes, but this is lightning in a bottle. Mm-hmm.
And it's lightning in a bottle that was so successful that they release this. It tops the Billboard charts. And then they release like a 5-CD box set of B-sides to it. Mm-hmm. And that also goes
explodes.
Gold.
Yeah.
Like, the legacy of the Smashing Pumpkins and Billy Corgan in particular is one of like somehow managing to capture that kind of moment in the 90s when teenagers were real people. Everyone was thinking about young people and how they were, you know, being.
It was the first time I think where teenagehood, it was always a thing. It was a demographic
since the 50s.
But it only took up to the 90s where teen culture was different than whatever popular culture was.
Exactly. Like in the 1950s, people started making things like East of Eden, these things. You'd make a media product for teens, but I think maybe partially because of like the rollback of advertising rules and stuff by Reagan in the 80s. The 90s are a time when everyone's all of a sudden is allowed to advertise directly to kids and they're allowed to talk directly to children. You've got these magazines like Tiger Beat or like Teen Vogue or whatever starting to pop up, and you're starting to just be like, we don't need to make cool things that will appeal a bit to teens and also to everyone else. You can make a full media package that's like, the parents will never hear about this. The parents will be peering through their curtains at the strange teenagers doing strange things outside and being like, I've heard none of this. What are these kids up to?
Yeah.
And it's like, they managed to capture that zeitgeist with such all-consuming furor that, like, he's one of the few artists that, like, the Beatles did this at a certain point, too. The Smashing Pumpkins did it, depending on how much you like certain Toronto-based rappers. Drake, like, had a moment where, like, he was this unavoidable. But, like, just en masse, in bulk, they'd be putting out something like 50 songs a year, and they would all be finding purchase with someone. It was an incredible point in time, and it did lead to a certain amount of Smashing Pumpkins fatigue in some people,
for sure,
which we'll probably talk about a bit later.
A little bit, yeah.
But like,
but that kind of brings us to Melancholy.
But let's talk about Melancholy.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest albums of all time. It has this reputation of not only being the defining moment of the band, but I think it also is. It shows the prowess of what they were able to accomplish with Gish and Siamese Dream, and then it's kind of like a prelude to things off of like Adore and Machina a little bit, where they're adding a little bit more of that electronic sounds because, like I said earlier, it started off with those like new wave influences. I think being extremely influenced by Robert Smith and The Cure, which if you look at Billy Corgan and you do not see Robert Smith's influence, I think you need glasses for your glasses because it's kind of like unavoidable.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The same way where you'll see tons of like modern bands and you don't go, oh, they're taking from what made Smashing Pumpkins great.
Yeah.
Right. There's so many of that early 2000s, like Escape the Fate or like Falling in Reverse. I'm naming the worst possible
the worst
band.
People in existence.
Ron Radke. I'm coming for you.
Yeah. But like to name better examples, like, My Chemical Romance.
Yes, My Chemical Romance. I was going to say that, but I feel like it's such a...
That's the obvious one.
It is the obvious one.
Everyone knows that he would have absolutely chosen Billy Corgan as his father if he could have.
They are related.
Yeah, have you seen their faces?
I have. Yeah. No, even like most recently when they were doing that, like Billy Corgan played with My Chem, I was like, they have to be like second cousins or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which Joe Rogan is second cousins with...
I've heard this as
with Gerard Way, I think.
Yes. What an interesting thing.
Do what you will with that information. I guess, this is going to be an ode to no one.
Anyway, we've ranted for a bit. Here's an angry song.
Here's an angry song. Be upset, I guess. Have fun.
No way.
All right. That was an Ode to No One by the Smashing Pumpkins. Just so good.
Yep.
Truly just amazing. Just
It's fun because it's a song that is pure wankery, both instrumentally and emotionally and in the how it was made. It's a song like I've heard him talking about it before. And he like it's a song that was written at top volume directly into the written and recorded both at top volume and directly into the amplifier, so you're getting constant feedback, and it's like killing you to actually be recording this thing just in your ears,
just tearing them up.
It's a song that was a monument to just the ego of someone who's like, these kind of abstract words are my actual feelings and they mean a lot and you need to hear it. And it's like,
I think that like, okay, I talked about the, we've been like moving around it a little bit, even in between songs and stuff. Yeah. But there's the frontman-itis.
Yeah, yeah, Billy Corgan.
Billy Corgan, and you could talk about it with hundreds of bands, like dozens of bands, really, or, you know, frontmen who are so within themselves when it comes to their music, and that it shapes their philosophy on life to the point where they have to expel it every single time that they're given a microphone. I've seen the Smashing Pumpkins perform twice now. Billy Corgan does not shut up.
Nope.
And that's a common thing to know amongst fans, that when you go to a concert, it'll be maybe, I want to say, a good 35% of them actually playing music, and then just the rest of it is him talking about whatever. It's just a yapper, truly. And it's never anything of note.
Never.
But it sounds profound. The John Lennon that the Beatles are bigger than Jesus.
Yeah.
A lot of people in the past years have attributed this to like Kurt Cobain. This prophet, this self-prophet that has dubbed him like self as such. Of he is a pillar of whatever genre he is this person spearheading.
Yeah.
So we have to listen to them. Because whatever they say has to be important. They made all this great art, so that means they have no wrong opinions.
It really is a credit to, or not a credit to, but it has been a massive benefit to Kurt Cobain's legacy that he did die young. It was a tragedy, but like,
Saved himself a little bit.
Yeah, he saved his legacy. He could have made a lot more beautiful music, but also he had the cops called on him for domestic abuse at a certain point. So Billy Corgan is what happens when you have someone who's he's got such a fraught kind of relationship with the people around him, and he doesn't shut up, like you're saying.
It's true, yeah.
He doesn't ever take the opportunity to let anyone else take the fore. He doesn't, he barely gives anyone else songs on the albums. Mm-hmm. Again, it was a double album, Melancholy, and
it's all him.
Not quite.
For the most part.
The last song on the first disc is James Iha's own thing. It's,
we can check right now.
Yeah.
It's, Take Me Down.
Yeah, Take Me Down to the Underground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that. And apparently that pissed off James Iha pretty bad.
Yeah, for
that he stuck him just right at the end.
Ugh.
And I don't know. You really see in the trajectory of the band after here
why they started to fall apart. I think right. Like their bassist soon left.
Their bassist would leave after the next album.
After Adore.
Their drummer would be kicked out of the band for heroin
and almost
addiction,
like killing someone. We should bring up a little bit. Jimmy Chamberlain suffered through a narcotics addiction, and I believe the keyboardist also. One night they were hanging out.
They both OD'd in a hotel room, and the keyboardist did end up dying. And as a result, Billy Corgan, in what was honestly kind of a heads-up move, was like, hey, dude, go get yourself clean and come back. And so the next album, Adore, is a real black sheep in the Smashing Pumpkins catalog. Although this is, I think, a less popular opinion now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've gotten to the point that calling Adore underrated is now like, we get it, buddy.
You're so
like,
different.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You Adore, why don't you talk a bit about what Adore was? What made it special?
like I said, early on, they kind of took influence, again, from those, like, new wave sounds. So they were using a drum machine. And sans a drummer, they go back to those electronic sounds, which they got flack for. Something common throughout, just... If you go back and read up on Smashing Pumpkins, the amount of beefs they have with other bands and like just the interpersonal dynamics of the band themselves, it was a mess. But Adore is this kind of... it's a black sheep because of how departed they were from the melancholy sound.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot more electronic focused. Not to say that there is no guitar or they've completely removed from the more like alt rock sound, but it's definitely what's the word?
It was a distinct departure and like a purposeful departure from mm-hmm. what they had done from this kind of box that Billy Corgan had built for himself of like being a alt rock kind of like kid in a basement
mm-hmm.
when deep down he wanted to wear dresses and makeup and in a very goth way. Mm-hmm. And by dresses, I mean a gigantic long robe. And by makeup, I mean cat's eyes that went to his temples
and completely shave his head. And,
absolutely.
Paint it completely like stark white.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And a star on his forehead. So mm-hmm. Adore really represents a move into an entirely electronic goth kind of sound
mm-hmm.
That, like you were saying, ruffled a lot of feathers. It sold horribly when it came out compared to Melancholy. It still sold okay, but it like for what they were, it was a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And like it was, but this was something that was purposeful. Billy
yeah.
Corgan's mm-hmm. mother had was
passed away,
had just
and
died.
A member leaving the band.
A member
right?
left the band. The band is tearing themselves
yeah.
apart mm-hmm. from the inside. The thing about Adore that I've seen argued before is like, honestly, like it was an attempt to escape that, but it was also a moment of not self-sabotage, but it was a kind of like screw you to the people who were just once again coming out every night and chanting for Bullet with Butterfly Wings,
pretty much
asking to be the serenaded mm-hmm. about how sad he was or whatever.
Yeah.
At all times, the name of the album Adore, I've seen pointed to as like, it's a homophone for like Adore. This album is literally an escape
mm-hmm.
from the kind of pattern that he was stuck in before. And like, it's noticeably an attempt to become a lot more mature.
Mm-hmm.
The
execution?
Yeah, the execution of it is in lyrics, in the way that it holds back both rhythmically and melodically, sometimes allowing you to just be focusing in on strange little sounds that they add or the wash that they put in the background. It combines with, again, a much more mature approach to writing lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
The song that you're going to play next, Perfect,
yes,
is a very like mature, shockingly mature approach to relationships
mm-hmm.
for the Smashing Pumpkins. The Smashing Pumpkins were a band that were all in on angst, like we've been talking about this whole time, and Perfect is this kind of ode to a relationship that keeps falling apart, that's finding itself, but will never be the way it was before. And kind of a crystallizing moment of a goodbye at the end of a relationship that you know isn't working, that's kind of got to disappear, but like you're praying it'll come back. It's this very self-conscious in a way that just music for children really isn't. I
mm-hmm.
think Billy Corgan said at the end of the tour for Melancholy that he was, I think, 27. And he was at this point when he was losing touch with that youth
mm-hmm.
in him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was specifically in that mode that says, like, I am no longer able to do what I have been doing. I've got to find a new way to present myself that doesn't involve just, like, screaming from my guts at all times like a child.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so with all that, we're going to play Perfect. Off of the Smashing Pumpkins album, Adore. right. That was perfect.
That was also the name of the song.
Yeah, it was perfect, and it was perfect. We don't have a lot of time, but the one question, the big question that we've been kind of dancing around all for the past hour, does Billy Corgan and his personality and who he is, does that detract from the band?
What do you think? Because I have an answer to this.
It's okay. I have mixed feelings. I think in recent years, the more he's given himself a platform to speak about the band, the worse it's gotten in retrospect. Because I think it's less about what he's saying and more about this guy who's a little questionable, is kind of destroying his own legacy by just keeps on saying weird things. He keeps going on Joe Rogan and all these different like podcasts and talking about his like thoughts on the world. And I don't care about your geopolitical opinions. I care about what you believe about art and music, which maybe goes in line with like the sound, that angsty sound, but having an over emotional melodramatic response when you're 19 and into your 20s, that's all fine and dandy, right? He said that all rock and roll was dead in like 1998, and I was like, I hate to break it to you, but we've been riding pretty high for the past 25 years of some great acts. Mm-hmm.
He was, in all fairness, touring a goth electronic album at the time, so that could have been some clever marketing. Mm-hmm. Just like, hey guys, don't listen to the rock and roll. You know what you should be listening to?
Us.
Yes, yeah. A song that just goes beep, boop, boop, boop.
I love when songs go beep 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 boop boop.
Yes, and if you also love that, listen to Tear by the Smashing Pumpkins off of a door. But the point is, I hear everything that you're saying, but I disagree.
Okay.
Like, for me, I don't think the Smashing Pumpkins could exist in the way they do if there wasn't like just an all-consuming black hole of an ego at the center of it all. Mm-hmm. Because like you alluded to in that, I feel that is what the music is. Mm. It's music for like losers in the kind of like almost like cool kind of skater way.
Yeah.
That's like, man, like everything sucks and it feels like no one likes me all the time.
So let me just like push and like try to like.
Billy Corgan says these things that you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, I'm going to get on board with a couple things that you said there. I think Billy Corgan should shut up about politics.
Please.
Because he's an idiot. But also, like, I'm a big fan of him continuing to claim things about the music business and about the legacy of the Smashing Pumpkins and the effect that every album that he writes has on him and on the music and their discography. Because I need him to be someone who's absolutely insane. Like to still feel that music is a warrant to be unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Smashing Pumpkins for me will always be like a safe place in the stars in your room or in whatever, where it's just like, this is where you go when like the rules don't make sense anymore. Everything makes you angry. Everything makes you sad. And you can't go and talk to people about that necessarily, because if you're honest with yourself, it's kind of
you sound insane a little bit. Yeah.
You sound a little insane. You sound a little unreasonable. You're a little bit like, oh man, maybe I should have slept a bit more last night. And actually I shouldn't be blowing up at everyone because like, oh, someone made a decision that I'm not happy with or something.
I took one wrong step and now my whole day is ruined.
And
the only person that can save me is Billy Corgan and the Smashing Pumpkins.
I could explain this to my friends, but they'd give me rational and wise advice, and that's not what I want in this moment.
No, I don't want to listen to you right now. Exactly. I want to sit in my angst and
I already know the rational and wise advice, and I've chosen already not to take it, so what I'm going to do is stew for a moment here. What I'm going to do is stew for approximately, let's say, 5 minutes and 49 seconds.
Or okay, so I'm debating. We did not have nearly enough time that I thought. I put in a dozen songs.
Yeah.
How do we want to end this hour?
So we talked about ending with the Everlasting Gaze.
Yes.
And I think that would remain a beautiful decision.
Mm-hmm.
Which
one of the very last songs after they took a hiatus.
Indeed, the last song they ever wrote, in fact. And then the band were all kidnapped and they went to Venus.
And they never made music again.
They never made music again. The everlasting gaze is that a beautiful kind of image of like the kind of end of the band, in that like
the perfect freeze frame.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They do the alt rock, but like in this final album, he's bringing in this kind of like
coldness.
Yes, yeah. It's the production is weird. He's got Flood back, but it's not the same.
No,
it's
The bass. We should mention
they swapped out the bassist.
They swapped out the bassist for multiple reasons. I believe
they all hated each other.
They all hated each other. Largely because James Iha and
Darcy Retzky
broke up. Yeah, they were in a relationship and then they broke up. There's so much we didn't get to talk about. Billy Corgan wrote some songs for Hole.
Well, Billy Corgan wrote some songs for Hole. Billy Corgan got Pavement kicked off of Lollapalooza.
That
Billy
is very
Corgan,
much true. Had beef with Trent Reznor, and that's why you see him like destroying a busk of him.
Yeah.
In what video is it for? Nine Inch Nails. You can search it up online. Just search up Trent Reznor and Billy Corgan beef. There's a long history of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Multiple members of the Smashing Pumpkins went and joined. And once the Smashing Pumpkins fell apart, Billy Corgan made a new band and then kicked everyone out of that as well, because he said that they were even more evil than the Smashing Pumpkins. And one of those guys was the guitarist from Slint.
Oh, my God.
Like David Paggio or Paho. It's a real weird like moment in Billy Corgan's history, and it's a beautiful portrait of an artist who couldn't stop just trying to get people to do what he did, but like it never worked again, because the beauty of the early Smashing Pumpkins stuff is that it's beautiful because Billy Corgan couldn't just run wild as much as he wanted to. Although Siamese Dream,
he's running pretty wild. I feel for the most part.
Yeah, he was running wild. He re-recorded every string instrument part and then like beat Jimmy Chamberlain's fingers to nubs re-recording.
Talk about one of the worst people to have in the producers, like in the studio. Just the worst perfectionism.
Oh yeah,
and on display. But he's an artist.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are running out of time.
All right.
And so I'm going to play The Everlasting Gaze as a final song to a band that has never made music ever again.
Yeah.
That was our final song. Oh, sorry.
That was a lie.
No, you get more. If you do want to check it out, I have the Spotify playlists up on my personal Spotify my personal Spotify. I don't know how we're going to get that out to them.
We can put it on the description of the show online.
Fantastic. Cool. All right. Yeah, it'll have all the upcoming or previous songs. But thank you for listening for the past hour, letting us angst it out to the Smashing Pumpkins.
Do some ranting.
Thank you, Nate, for having for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
Always love to hear a longtime hardcore fan of any band and what is so special to them. But thank you for joining us. I'm going to be here next week, doing a little bit different, back to the usual mix. But thank you for listening to Who Listens to This Crap. My name is Matthew, and have a great day.